My name is Terry Cruz, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
well, hello, Nashville. My God. I am so excited to be here. Oh, my God. This has been on my calendar for a long, long time. And about a month ago, I don't know if it was Steve or someone had sent me a copy of the flyer for this event. And when I saw the lineup of speakers, I was like, oh, my God. This is going to be epic because all my favorite people are here, and so far they've all slammed it out of the park, and I'm just grateful that I'm not in the Sunday morning slot because by then the bar is all the way up at the ceiling, and sorry, Georgia, but she's going to do a great job, so be sure to stick around tomorrow morning for Georgia. So anyway, I want to thank Laura and her friend Angel for picking me up at the airport yesterday. I haven't got to see a whole lot of Nashville. I went to a restaurant last night called Etchings, or was it Etches? Etch. Wow, that was really incredible. So if you haven't been there yet, go down there and check that out. I'm going to give them a plug. And the people, I guess what's really standing out to me is that southern drawl. There's just something so safe and gentle and about the accent of the people that live around here. I just love it. And the energy in this room is very enthusiastic, and it just feels like home. So whenever I go to an AA event or a conference, and I always feel like I'm around my kind of people. I feel like I'm at home. And I just want to thank you for welcoming me, because 25 years ago, nobody wanted me anywhere. My life has changed so much as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm just going to go back to the beginning. I've got a sobriety date. It's October the 17th, 1993. I have a sponsor. Her name is Janet F. of Columbus, Ohio. I have a home group, Gibsonburg, Wednesday night. And those three things make me a member of good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I suit up and I show up. I am sponsored. I sponsor other women. I have worked the steps, and I continue to work them. And I take other women through the steps, and I consider myself to be actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I attend meetings on a regular basis every week. And this thing has changed my life because it gave me a design for living, because I don't naturally know the next right thing to do. I don't naturally know the answer to simple questions that my husband, you know, if I ask him a question about one of the granddaughters, like, he just naturally knows what the right thing is. And I wasn't raised like that. I was raised in a single parent home by my older sister, Pam. There was just the two of us, me and my sister, and then my mom, who was a bartender. So oftentimes in the evenings, my mom was away at work, and it was just me and my sister. And when I look back on my childhood, I don't have warm, fuzzy memories of family vacations and sitting around the dinner table and all the stuff that normal people do. I didn't know what normal was. Alcohol has always, always been a part of my life. Ever since I can remember, my mom used to, I told you she worked as a bartender, but on the weekends, sometimes she would just like disappear. Like she would disappear on Friday and would not resurface until Sunday. And it was just me and my sister, like all weekend. And we were little. I mean, like there's 2 years between us. So we were like maybe 7 and 9 years old, and just taking care of each other and basically her taking care of me. And, but I thought that's what everybody did. I didn't have anything to compare it to. And I grew up in a small town in northwest Ohio near Toledo. Woodville, Ohio is a little population of 2,000. Everybody knows everybody in Woodville. And it was a pretty safe place back in the 1970s. If anybody mentioned the word heroin, everybody went, oh, my God. And, of course, today that has a whole new face on it. So I grew up in a very rural town, and I still live there today. I love my hometown. It was a very safe place to raise children, and to some extent it still is today. And so, but I knew right away, from my earliest recollections, that there was something about me that was different. And it just seemed like everybody else, like when they were passing out confidence and self-esteem and how to socialize and relate and be a good friend and just normal social skills that most people have, I missed that line. Like I wasn't, you know, I got into the let's not be comfortable in our own skin line and struggle for your whole life to have a little bit of self-esteem. You know, I just seemed like I got stuck over there. And what I found out when I took alcohol for the very first time is that all those feelings of unworthiness and not fitting and being different and not comfortable in my own skin was gone, like in an instant, gone, kapush. And I knew right away that me and alcohol were going to have a very long relationship. And I think I was like maybe 15 or 16 when I had my first drunk. And looking back on it, I don't remember a whole lot about the first drunk other than the fact that I had a blackout the very first time that I got drunk. And I know today, as having been in AA for 24 years, that social drinkers don't have blackouts. Only alcoholics have blackouts. And I had a blackout the first time I got drunk, what does that say about me? I don't know. I know my mother was drinking during her pregnancy with me, and I think I was swimming in it in utero. Like, it was a matter of time for me. So anyway, I have my first drink at age 16, and I put the plug in the jug at age 28. And during that 12-year window, I wreaked a whole lot of havoc in a whole lot of lives, and I caused a lot of trouble. At the bottom of page 33 in the big book, Bill Wilson writes something to the effect, I'm just going to paraphrase, because I always get it wrong, and I don't need to be corrected in the thank you line, so I'm just going to paraphrase it. He says something like, potential female alcoholics often cross the line and become the real thing in a very short period of time. Now, how did he know to write that in the late 1930s when the membership numbered about 100 men? That's what the book said. But there it is. It's at the bottom of page 33. You can look it up and read it, and it's true. So I have my first drink at age 16, and by age 18, I am a full-blown alcoholic off to the races. I managed to graduate from high school, and I don't know how. I have no clue how I did that. And I moved in with this 32-year-old man. Actually, when I was 16, I moved in with this 32-year-old man when I was 16. Who does that? Like, if one of my granddaughters even had the notion that I would, we won't even go there, but it would get really ugly. And that's what I did, and it was okay. Like, she just let me go. And so anyway, I grew up in the fast lane. And so I'm doing all the wrong things. I become a blackout drinker. Any blackout drinkers in the room? Oh, yeah. And so I'm waking up in strange places, and I don't recognize the wallpaper. I'm wrecking cars. I'm getting DUIs. I'm unemployable. But this guy that I live with is this big drug lord, you know, and he travels to Texas and Florida from Ohio. And so he has friends down in, like, El Juarez or some city, some Mexican city that has a pilot's license, and they're flying. It's just incredible stuff that was totally illegal. I could have probably been doing life in prison for some of the stuff that I've done. And so there was a lot of money. I didn't really need to work. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. There was a lot of cash, and a lot of cash. So I'm going to just fast forward the tape because there's so much I want to cram in this afternoon. I'm going to take us to April 3rd, 1993. I'm 28 years old. I've been drinking since I was 16. It's a Friday night. I'm with my sister. I'm sitting on a bar stool in Genoa, Ohio. And on this Friday night, I start drinking at 5. Somewhere along the way, I got a message inside my head that if you drink before 5 o'clock, it means that you're an alcoholic, because only alcoholics do that. And so I would suffer with these horrible hangovers, and I never, ever drank before 5. So on this particular day, right at 5 o'clock, I started drinking. And my sister and I were at a bar. Actually, we were bar hopping. And at about midnight, this guy I was dating came in. His name was Tony. And he was drunk, I was drunk, my sister was drunk, and we were going to move to another bar about 5 miles down the road. So Tony hopped in his Camaro, and my sister and I hopped in my Buick, and I was following him down State Route 51, and I was maybe a mile from the farmhouse, maybe two at the very most, from the farmhouse where I had just spent the last 10 years of my life. And there's one curve on that road, one. You don't even have to slow down for the curve. It's not even a sharp curve. It's a small curve, but you have to negotiate it. You have to turn your wheels to the right. And of course, as I entered into the curve, I was arguing with my sister, and I took my eyes off the road, and I was shouting something at her, and I was drunk, and I went into that curve, and I never turned my wheels to the right. I just kept going straight on a forward path, and I struck an oncoming car, and I kill a 14-year-old boy that's in the back seat of that car. That's what I did. And the gig was up. You know, and that's where the place where the energy in the room, I just feel it rushing up here at me. And it is shocking. And it's sad. And it's tragic. And those are the sort of things that practicing alcoholics do. That's what I did. And so in the summer of 1993, after that happened, I had several court appearances. I had like an arraignment and a pretrial and a this and a that, and you know, I'd never been in that kind of trouble before, just DUIs and misdemeanors, and I'm appearing in the felony court system, and I'm on the news, I'm on the front page of the Toledo Blade. Everybody knows my name all of a sudden, and it's mud, big time mud, and I was so ashamed. And I don't want to paint a picture of a young woman who was unremorseful, but I would say to you that I was as emotionally remorseful as I was capable of being at that time of my life, because I was so immersed in my alcoholism that I couldn't see the forest through the trees. I couldn't get my brain around the enormity of what I had done. So I dealt with it by ignoring it, by stuffing it on a shelf, by drinking. In the summer of 1993, I would continue to drink. And I'm ashamed of that. So on October 19th, 1993, I had my sentencing hearing. And at my sentencing hearing, the only person I wanted in the courtroom was my mother, and she showed up and she was there to support me, and I had an attorney, a court-appointed attorney. And the boy's family showed up, and so did Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. So there was like 200 people trying to cram into this little courtroom, and they were pulling chairs out of closets, and the media was there. They were all in the jury box with their cameras, and I just remember thinking to myself, I wish they would put handcuffs on me and just leave me out of here, because I couldn't face that woman. And I remember when the judge gave me my sentence, which he sentenced me to 4 to 10 years in prison. And I could have gave me a 2 to 10, a 3 to 10, a 4 to 10, or a 5 to 10. And I walked in the courtroom expecting 5 to 10, which is the maximum penalty. And he gave me a 4 to 10, so I was relieved about that. He took my driver's license for the rest of my life, told me I'd never drive again in the state of Ohio, or any of the other 50 states for that matter. And he banged his gavel, and all I could hear was my mom's screams echoing off the courtroom walls. And this boy's mom was maybe 15 feet off to my right, and she was sobbing hysterically and unconsolable. And I'm just ashamed to report to you that I didn't have an ounce of compassion for either one of those women, because I was numb. I couldn't feel a thing. All I wanted was to get out of that room and to be locked into a cell and be put away from everybody else. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I always just say, well, I'm not hurting anybody but myself, right? This is my life. Why don't you just get off my back? I'm not bothering you, right? And there's these two women. There's this 14-year-old boy in his grave. But I'm not bothering anybody. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. So many lives affected. So they put handcuffs on me. They led me next door to the county jail, and I would sit there for about a week waiting to be driven down to Central Ohio to the female maximum security prison in the state of Ohio in Marysville, and to begin my sentence. And about a week later, they rode me down there and dropped me off. And I found myself in a sea of 2,000 women. And I can't stand women. And all women say, you never hear men come up here and say, I couldn't stand men. They never say that, but the girls always say that. I don't know. I think I figured it out. We'll get there later, but that was a long road. So I'm a manipulator. So back in the day, it was really cute, and I used to use my good looks, you know, to manipulate men, get me a free drink, right? Ever do that? You know, I would pride myself. I'd go to the bar. I'd have $10 in my purse, and I'd wake up the next morning. I still had $10 in my purse. You know, I'd wake up and not recognize the wallpaper. One time we went over to the islands. Me and my best friend Lisa ended up on, started out Thursday night, Put-in Bay, South Bass Island in Lake Erie. It's a party island, right? And last cognizant memory I have, her and I are in the restroom. We ripped off all of our clothes. We're drunk, right? So we got naked. Isn't that what all girls do in the bathroom? And we ripped off all of our clothes, and I put on her outfit. She put on my outfit. We went back out there to see if these guys realized that we had switched outfits. And that's the last memory I have. I wake up, and I look around the room, and I don't recognize the wallpaper. And last thing I knew, I was at the beer barrel on South Bass Island. And I look out the window, and I see lots of trees and a forest, and I see a barn, and I think, gosh, I must be on a farm somewhere. And I go down a flight of steps, and there's this large, obese man sitting at a kitchen table smoking his big, nasty cigar, and he says, well, there's my sunshine. I'm thinking, oh, my God. Please don't let me be his sunshine. Because it was really bad. But I wasn't flattened like a pancake, so it must not have been too bad. And so that's not as bad as Sheldon's foreskin joke, okay? That's not as bad. So anyway, I come to find out that last I knew it was Thursday night. It's Sunday morning, and I'm on a different island. I'm over on Middle Bass Island. I've moved islands, and like 3 days have passed. I couldn't tell you. To this day, you would think like maybe 25 years later, God would give me a little bit of, maybe I don't need to know, you know. And so that's the way I drank. That's the way I live my life. And so I digressed. I do that. So let's go back to prison. Ugh. And so I get out in population down in Marysville, and I had developed these quirky behavior patterns, you know, because I'm a manipulator. I used to manipulate men, and the only men that are around me now are employees of the state of Ohio, and they're not trying to hear it. And there's nothing that they can give me anyway because I'm an inmate. And so I had to wear these khaki pants, and I had to wear this khaki shirt every day. And, you know, my hair and my makeup became very important, and I would, you know, I would iron my khaki pants, and I had these creases, and I thought, you know, if I could just fix up the outside, I could fool you, and you would think I was okay on the inside, right? I've been doing that my whole life. I'm this chameleon, and my life sucked. And I look back on that, you know, particularly that first and second year during my incarceration, and I was just like the boy that whistles in the dark, you know. I was whistling in the dark to keep my spirits up, to act like I'm okay, and I'm dying on the inside. But I'm dying of untreated alcoholism, and I hadn't had a drop of alcohol in a year or two. See, you can take the alcohol away from the alcoholic, but if you don't insert a program of recovery, if you don't introduce some kind of God and some kind of step work or something, that person is still suffering with the effects of alcoholism, just like I was. And so the other inmates there had nicknamed me Barbie. I know that's hard to believe. I know. And I just thought, oh, you're all just jealous of me because I'm cute and I come from a nice family. See, that's the facade that I wanted to put on, right? That I came from this nice, middle-class, rural Ohio family. And I didn't. I don't know. But anyway, so they had called me Barbie. And somewhere along the way, this rumor had begun to circulate why I was there. See, I wouldn't tell anybody why I was there. It was this big secret because, I don't know about Tennessee, but in the state of Ohio, if you've harmed a child or done anything to a child and the other inmates get wind of that, they will make your stay extremely difficult. We don't hurt the babies. And I was horrified that they might find out that I had killed a 14-year-old boy, despite the fact that it was an accident. I wasn't taking any chances, so I never told anybody why I was there. So this rumor had developed that I was locked up because I had robbed some big executive bank, and I was some executive in Ohio at a bank, and I embezzled all this millions of dollars, and I liked that rumor. I thought, you know, this means that I'm college educated, and that, you know, I had millions of dollars I was throwing away. But the truth of the matter is being a girl that robbed a bank, to me, was a whole lot better than being a girl that had killed a 14-year-old boy. And so I just kind of rolled with that rumor. And I had a parole hearing coming up in May of 1996. Back in the day, you know, I think if you did, like, for every 1 year you were sentenced to, you had to do, like, 8 months or something like that. I don't remember. But I had served, like, just under 3 years, and my first parole hearing was coming up. And, you know, and I'm not stupid. I thought, maybe I should go to some AA meetings, right? I'm here for an alcohol-related crime. I'm going to go to a parole hearing, and they're going to look at my attendance and what I've been doing since I've been here, and maybe they'll smile on me and let me go home. And so I was going to AA for all the wrong reasons, right? And when I say this, it's like, you know, how many of us came in here skipping and whistling and just so happy to be here? I can't wait to go to AA. You know, we get in here because there's a monkey on our back, and it's either a spouse or an employer or a judge. There's usually something going on, and we go to the back of the room, and we sit in the cool section and hope that nobody talks to us, and we get there right before the meeting starts, and as soon as it's over, we bolt out the door, and, you know, that's how most people get here. I think that's pretty normal for arriving at Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know. And so I'm going for all the wrong reasons, and it doesn't matter. And in May of 1996, in the month leading into my parole hearing, there were other inmates there for vehicular homicide. So I was watching their cases very closely to see what the parole board did to them to help gauge what they might do to me. And there was a lady there from Sandusky, Ohio. Her name was Katrina. And Katrina was doing a 5 to 10. And Katrina had already been to the parole board. I think she did like, I don't know, 3 years or whatever it was. And then they gave her two more. So on a 5 to 10, she'd served 5 years, day for day. Everybody was sure she was going home. She had served her minimum sentence. She wasn't a trouble inmate. She'd never gotten in any troubles. And I was sitting outside in the cold Cleveland winter waiting for her to come out, and she did. And she was pretty hysterical, and I said, "What just happened in there?" And she said, "They just gave me the whole 10 years, day for day. They stripped me of my good days. In fact, I'm not even eligible to be housed. By now, I forgot to tell him at the pre-release center in downtown Cleveland, Ohio. She said, I'm not even eligible to be housed here anymore. I'm going back to Marysville today." I'm like, "Oh, my God." I'm like, "Why?" And she's like, "I don't know." And they put her in a white minivan and drove her out, like, that day. And that was, like, in January of 96. And maybe a month or two later, a gal from Cleveland, her name was Denise, she was doing a 2 to 10 for vehicular homicide. And the victim in her accident was her best friend in the passenger seat of her car. They had been childhood best friends their whole life. And she was, like, in her 20s. She was a young woman. And we were all pretty sure that Denise would go home because the girl's mom, the victim, was encouraging them to release her. Like, she had was basically a member of their family, and she had forgiven her. And I was sitting outside in the Cleveland cold winter, and Denise came out of her hearing, and she was pretty hysterical. And I said, "What happened?" She said, "They gave me the whole 10 years, day for day." I said, "What? Even after her mom wrote that letter?" And she said, "Yeah." And they put her in a white van and drove her back to Marysville and dropped her off. And I promptly went straight to my housing unit and got on the phone, and I called my mom. I said, "Mom, this isn't looking so good for me. They're giving all the vehicular homicides the whole 10 years. I'm afraid." And my mom said, "Oh, don't, you know, you'll be fine. You don't know their whole story. Maybe more than one person was killed. Maybe they have multiple prior DUIs. You know, don't compare yourself to her. You'll be fine." And then the next month, I get to my first parole hearing, and I'm not fine. The Ohio Parole Board gave me the whole 10 years, day for day, in one fell swoop, stripped me of all the good days that I'd already earned and set in place that I'd never earn another one, just like they were doing everybody else, put me in a white van and drove me back down to Marysville and dropped me off. And there I sat in admissions, locked in a box. It's just like you see on TV, with a sink, a bunk, and a toilet, and another person that you're using the bathroom in front of, locked in a box, waiting to be assigned a bed out in population. And I couldn't even cry. I couldn't even cry. I was so numb, so removed from my feelings that I couldn't even cry. And I look back at that woman, and it just breaks my heart. And I think of how sick I was. Like, that's a sickness. This thing is a feelings disease. I can't feel my feelings. And when they come up, I want to stuff them down, drink them down, sex them down, rub them down. I don't care. Just make it go away. Because I can't handle it. I don't know what to do with it. And I'm weird and I'm awkward. And I don't fit. Right? I just don't fit. And so they give me a bed out in population. And, I had the staff down there all fooled. They all thought, "Oh, she's just this nice, sweet girl from the country, right? Because I'm a chameleon. I could fool you." And that's what I do. That's my game. And so they gave me this really cushy job working up in the warden's area. I had my own office, my own desk. I had three inmate runners that were assigned to me. Their job was to sit on a church pew in the hallway outside of my office and wait for me to finish typing one of these very important documents, bed moves. I was doing bed moves. And I would holler, "I need a runner." And if one was there, they could come in my office and take this document and go with it. Now, if that doesn't feed your ego in the penitentiary, I don't know what will. And there I was, trying to be all I could be in the penitentiary. And just a sick puppy, a sick puppy. So one day I typed up all these bed moves, and it was getting to be like, I don't know, it was after 3 o'clock, and there's a 4 o'clock count. Like, and that count time, I know most of you have not been in prison, so let me break this down. Like, 6 or 7 times during a 24-hour period, everybody gets counted. And when count time happens, everybody go to your bed, get on your bed, stay on your bed, keep your mouth shut, no movement, and it takes like 45 minutes, and then count clears. Once count clears, everybody's free to go and do your thing. And so there was a 4 o'clock count coming up, and I typed up all these bed moves, and these inmates, count's not going to clear because they're in this bed right now, but I typed up all these bed moves, and they're supposed to be in these beds over here. I was doing seniority moves, and I couldn't find Lieutenant Wasmer to sign off on them, so I walked into the tie office. I said, "Miss Floyd, could you sign off on all these bed moves? It's 3:30, and if these girls don't get packing, that 4 o'clock count's never going to clear." And she said, yeah, come on in here. And I stepped inside her air-conditioned office, and she said, I want to talk to you anyway, Terry. And I said, yeah. And she said, I've been thinking, there's a really good program over at Recovery Services called Hearts. Have you ever thought about treatment? I said, treatment? Treatment for what? Right? I don't know. So this woman who worked with me every day, Monday through Friday, this was a woman, let me preface this. So like this was a lady who never wore the same dress twice. Every lock of hair was in place. Her makeup was always perfect. She never once treated me like an inmate. You know, she always showed me kindness and respect, and I held her in very high esteem. And so when she said that to me, I took it at value, and I said to her, I said, Miss Floyd, I said, I really appreciate that. I said, but I've been locked up for 5 years, and I got 5 more to go. I'm going to do these other 5 years, and then I'm going home. I'm not doing the AA, the victim's awareness, because you know why? And I didn't tell her this, but I'm thinking it. There's nothing in it for me. I can't even earn a good day. I'm doing 10 years day for day. I'm not doing it. And then she said the magic words that my ego just loved to hear. She said, well, you know, there's a 2-year waiting list to get into that program, and I can pick up the phone and make a phone call, and I can get you into the next group. I said, well, sign me up, right? I mean, she finally realized, someone realized how important I am, and I'm moving to the front of a 2-year waiting list, and that's a big deal in the penitentiary, right? So she put me on the list. And so she makes the phone call, and I get put in the next group, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, whenever the next group was starting, because they had like 3 that were rotating intermittently. And so what they had to do was reassign my job, so now I don't work in the count office anymore. I'm a student. My job description is student in the HEARTS program. I need to report to Recovery Services Monday through Friday from, like, I don't know, it's 8 to 4 or something like that, with a count time at noon and then followed by a lunch, and then we go back for the afternoon session. And I had no idea what I had signed myself up for. This was an intense behavior modification program, and I didn't know anything about it. And I found out real quickly how deep doo-doo I was in, some seriously deep doo-doo. The program, I just want to preface it, just to give you an idea of what it was like. There was maybe 15 inmates that are in this circle, in this room. 14 of us are going through the program. We're sick and suffering alcoholics, and the 15th inmate is employed by Recovery Services Department. She's already been through the program, and her title is peer leader, and she's there to give feedback. And then the other woman in the circle is licensed by the state of Ohio, and she's a drug and alcohol counselor, and she's actually making this group happen. And her name was Betsy Johnson, and we're friends on Facebook today, and I actually, when I tagged myself coming down here, she just gets all excited. She follows my story. She's a really interesting person. And so anyway, Betsy Johnson is heading this group of these women, and just to give you an idea, on Wednesday, like the second weekend, we come back from lunch, we circle up around the table, and the girl that sat across from me was locked up because she killed her daughter. I don't know. It was a story I heard out in the yard. It was none of my business, and we circled up around the table, and the counselor looked at her and said, why don't you tell the story about what you did to your daughter? And I remember sitting there thinking, she is not going to go there. And this girl went there, and she told a story, and I'm not going to repeat it here, but I would just say to you, it was as bad as it gets. And I'm only sharing this to tell you how the program was set up, because when you finish sharing, you receive your feedback, and during the feedback process, the way the program was set up, both feet are flat on the floor, both hands are flat on the table, and you do not speak. And your feedback could go on for 2 hours, and you might have snot hanging down off your chin and mascara smeared everywhere. There'll be no tissues. We're not going to tidy that up. Those hands are glued to the table. Now, there was an escape route available. If it got so hot that you couldn't take it, you were allowed to jump up and run out of the room. If you did, you couldn't come back. You were done with the program, and the next day you would be assigned to cafeteria, and which is horrible. Like, okay, I wouldn't want to do that. And so anyway, during this girl's feedback process, I could just tell you it was as bad as it gets. Man, they lit her up. And I remember sitting there thinking, like, and her feedback went on for like 2 hours. I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, like your turn is coming. There's going to be a day when they ask you about what you did, and you're going to be in the hot seat. And that was on Wednesday. And then Friday we came back from lunch, and we circled up around the table, and Betsy Johnson looked at me, and she said, why didn't you tell the story about the night you wrecked your car? And the first thought that goes through my mind is, great, going to get out to the yard that I didn't rob a bank, right? Because I'm always trying to save face. It's always about me. And the next thought was, you know what? Buck up, because you were expecting it anyway. So I sit up straight and I tell this story. Now, the story I tell is, I wasn't in a blackout. I remember what happened in the road that night. So I tell a story, but not from my heart. I tell the story from my head. It's almost like there's this reel-to-reel video of, you know, our cars colliding and then the lights. And I was very detached. I tried to act like I was telling it from my heart. I tried to cry a little bit and put some feelings into it. And it was all a bunch of bull. And they saw right through it because I'm not any good. So when I got done telling the story, I put my hands flat on the table and my feet flat on the floor, and my feedback went something like this. Boy, if I didn't know any better, I'd think you were the victim. And you make me sick. You take no responsibility for what you did to that 14-year-old boy. And I can still see Betsy Johnson banging her fist on the table. Do you want to save face or save ass? Because you can't save both. And I wanted to save both. And I was crying, and I couldn't believe they were talking to me like that, right? Don't they know who I am? And this is awful. And then during the course of that afternoon, because it went on for like 2 hours, it just seemed like every time they opened their mouth, they had hammers and chisels and picks, and they just kept banging at my wall, banging at my wall. And at one moment during the course of that afternoon, I had just this brief moment of clarity where it just seemed to me that a beam of light had came through that wall that I had constructed between me and the rest of humanity and just pierced me right there. And I had this one moment where everything was crystal clear, and I thought, oh my God, what have you done? What have you done? And I got it. And then I quick shut that down because that was so intense, like I couldn't feel it, but it pushed me into that place in my soul. You know that one room? I think we've all got that room, that deep, dark and scary, where all the junk is at, that I'm never going to tell anybody. That place. There. And they led me into there. I just poked my head in there and jerked it back out. And that was on a Friday afternoon, and I just was crying. I was pretty hysterical, and I kept staring at that clock. I couldn't wait for the 4 o'clock whistle to blow. Let's go back and have some count time, right? I was just over it. And the whistle finally did blow, and I jumped up and I grabbed my book, and that counselor looked at me and she said, "Not so fast. When you get back to your room, I want you to write a letter to that 14-year-old boy." And I'm all crying and teary-eyed. I'm like, well, I don't know what to say, and it's just all going to be wrong anyway. And she's like, "I'm not going to tell you what to say. Just write a letter to that kid and bring it to group on Monday morning. Oh, and one more thing. When you go back, I want you to wash that makeup off. I don't want to see any more makeup on you. I'm placing you on makeup restriction for the next 2 weeks." And I said, whatever. I was so mad. I couldn't believe she was taking my cover girl. And that was like, was part of my mask, right? Oh, and let me, real quick, because I don't normally say this part, but you guys thought that was so funny. So 2 weeks later, you know, I come in and I got my hair and my makeup is done, and she's like, what? I said, "You said 2 weeks. It's been 2 weeks." She goes, "Okay, well, what'd you get out of that?" And I'm going to be a smart, right? "Well, I don't know. I didn't get anything out of that. I don't know what you did that for. That was no big deal. That wasn't nothing." She goes, "Good. So now you can have 4 weeks. So when you go back, wash that makeup off." And so as last I heard, which was about a year ago, I ended up with 6 weeks of makeup restriction. I still hold it in Marysville, Ohio. I hold the makeup restriction record. as of a year ago. I don't know. Maybe somebody may have broke it. I don't know. So let's go back to Friday, because what's happening on Friday is big stuff, right? I go back to my room at the 4 o'clock count, and I climb up on my bunk, and I proceed to write a letter to a 14-year-old boy. And it was 4 pages, and it was front and back. And it just flowed off that pen. And I'm saying things to this kid like, "You're never going to graduate high school. You're never going to marry a wife. You're never going to procreate. You're not going to go to college. You're not going to have a career. You'll never drive a car. I have taken all these things away from you and so much more. And I meant it. And I told him I was sorry." And it just seemed like those words were just so insignificant. "I'm sorry I killed you." Really? And on page 30 in the big book, Bill Wilson says, "We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic." Our innermost selves, that's the place. And if I said to you, "What do you mean, my innermost self? I don't know what that is. Where is that? How do I get there?" It's down here in the soul, at the gut level, my innermost self. And for the first time in my life, on that Friday, on that day, I was face to face with my innermost self. And it is horrifying the first time. I was so scared. So I get back to group on Monday morning, and I've got my letter, and we circle up around the table, and I looked at the counselor. I said, well, I've got my letter. She said, that's good. I said, well, I want to read it. She said, you will read it, but before we do that, I want to revisit group on Friday. I want you to tell these women the story about that night you wrecked your car, but this time, I want you to tell the truth. You could have blown me over with a feather. I thought, I can't possibly go through that again. And then the next thought was, you know what? Screw it. I'm never going to see these women again. Just tell the story. So I told the story. And it was the same story that it was on Friday. Like, the facts of what happened in the road that night will never change. But what changed was my perception, right? Because I don't see things the way that they really are. I see things the way that I am, right? And the way that I was on Friday was different than the way that I was on Monday, right? And I told you I was a stuffer, so I had been stuffing down over the course of that weekend all that stuff from like 30 years of stuff it down, kept coming up. It was right here in my throat. I was just choking on my own crud. Like, I needed to have an emotional vomit right there on the table, just get it out. So I told the story again. But this time it wasn't all about me and how horrible that event was for me. It was about Jane Miller. I saw his mom. I saw her. I saw her running down the road, away from her car, away from the scene of the accident, in the cold and in the darkness. And she probably ran maybe 50 yards. And then she stopped. And she was alone out there in the field. And she bent over and she grabbed her knees and she just screamed this really loud scream. And it's like her only son was bleeding to death in the back seat of her car. And this woman was an RN. She was a licensed nurse. And she could not save his life. She couldn't even free him out of the back seat. And I did that. That's what I did. So I got done telling the story, and I put my hands on the table and my feet flat on the floor to receive my feedback. And I looked up, and the counselor said, no, we're not going to do the feedback yet. I want you to read the letter. So I proceeded to read the letter that I wrote on Friday to the 14-year-old boy, a letter that had come from my heart. When I got done reading the letter, when I looked up, then I saw like 15 women. Like Friday, they all had their claws out. You know, everybody was, get there, bitch. And then on Monday morning, they were all crying. Like we were connected. It was like when I ventured into that place in my soul, that dark room, you know. You ever heard that phrase, you're only as sick as your secrets? Right? That's the place there. So when I go into that dark place where I had my six secrets, all that stuff, and it was like we took a lantern, all of us, and we went, I opened the door, let's go, come on, we're all going in there. It's kind of like doing a fourth and a fifth, you know. It's like, that's scary. I don't know if I want you to know all this stuff about me, but okay, here we go. And that was how I healed that. And in that space, in that circle on that morning with those women, like the tears that they were crying, those weren't for me. Because it unconsciously gave them permission to go to their place, right? And that's what happens in here. Like any tear that might be shed this afternoon, it's not for me. It's your stuff. And that's how this thing works, is we connect like that at a soul level. And that's where the healing happens. And so that's what's happening for me on Monday. And so I went on to graduate the group. There were, out of 14, there were two of us left. Not kidding, Mohicans left standing at the end of that group. Two women graduated that group. I was one of the two. I don't think I've ever said that from the podium. I don't say it to toot my horn. I say it to impress upon you that it was extremely difficult. And I was extremely motivated. And so when I finished the program, they offered me a job at Recovery Services, which I took that, and I immersed myself in recovery. And I started going to a meeting every morning. I had to put one together Monday through Friday. Like Monday might have been a big book. Tuesday could have been a 12 and 12. And whatever it was, I had to set up the tables and chairs and make that meeting happen. Then I was going in the evening because they had outside speakers coming in, and I really started getting involved in recovery. And I'm sitting out in the yard, and And the woman, the inmate who was the peer leader, her name was Sheila. She sat in on my group, and she was also employed at Recovery Services, and we became kind of tight. And she was kind of a lightweight, unofficial first sponsor for me, and we started, you know, talking about the steps out in the yard. And one day God came up, and she asked me about God, and I said, oh, you know, I believe that there's a God. I did believe that, but I believed that I was so bad and that I was just so disgusting, and that obviously because I missed all the stuff in that line that all you guys got, that he didn't let me have. Like, he had a bone against me from the very beginning. And how could you forgive that? I don't know why I'm feeling like this today. And I had this nightmare. I'm just going to shift gears right here because he's inside my head screaming, tell them about the dream. And so I had this dream today at 7 a.m. and I woke up. And I've been having a reoccurring nightmare once a month, every month, for about a decade. And I've never shared this from the podium, but I'm going to share it today because I feel like I'm compelled to. And in the dream, I did it again. I have committed vehicular homicide again. And it's never the exact same dream. Sometimes, nobody knows but me, right? Sometimes in the dream, I've already been through the court system and I'm incarcerated, but I don't have an out date. I don't have a day that I'm going home. And about a year ago, I was down in Texas, at Kerrville, Texas, in August last summer. Great conference. And I had the dream. And I was sitting there with my friend Lynn and Greg. They're tapers from this. They weren't taping that event. They just happened to be there. They lived nearby. And we were sitting around a table talking. And I was telling Lynn, this woman, about this dream. And I said, I've been having this dream for like a decade. And it's making me crazy. And I don't know how to make it go away. And you ever like just sit and have a conversation with someone. And while you're just talking about it, you arrive at the answer. And I arrived at this answer. And we were talking. And I said, well, you know, Lynn, I said this prayer, and I say this prayer all the time, and that my story, because I tell it over and over and over, and I'm so horrified that it would lose its impact if I ever, like, get desensitized and start telling it from my head instead of telling it from my heart. It's not going to have any impact, and people aren't going to be reached by it. And so I've been praying. I always say a prayer, God, please, like, don't ever let me get desensitized from my story. And then the thought occurred to me, she goes, well, when do you have the dream? I said, oh, always, always going into a weekend conference that I'm speaking at. And then I arrived at, oh my God, so the dream. So when I have the dream, what I should be, instead of going, oh my God, that's awful, I can't take it anymore. I woke up this morning in the middle of this. So this morning, here's what it looked like. It was different. So this morning, I'm in a courthouse. I've committed vehicular homicide again, and it's really bad. But I'm in this other room with all these alcoholics who've been in trouble, and I'm helping the alcoholics, but I'm supposed to be down in courtroom A getting sentenced. And Betsy Johnson walks into the room where I'm helping the alcoholics, and she's got this piece of paper. She said, Terry, honey, it's time. And she's crying, and I'm crying because I know it's getting ready to happen all over again. And then I sit up straight in the bed and I open my eyes and I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, and I got to speak at 2:30. And I was like, God, I should say thank you for keeping that fresh. And but man, that's hard. And so I don't know where all that came from, but there was 5 minutes of Terry's nightmare. And now I need a drink. Water. I have no idea. All right, so let's just move along. So let's talk about God. So I don't really have a God, and we're talking about God, and we're sitting out in the yard, and I told her, I said, you know what, if there really is a God, if that's true, you know, I really respected what Sheldon said last night. I don't think this part's going to work for me. Like, I got that. This isn't going to work for me. And I, she said, well, what have you got against God? Like, why would you say that? I said, really? Sheila, really? What kind of a God? I said, for instance, what kind of a God would have let that boy die in that accident that night? Why not me? Why didn't God save him? She said, really? why don't you, instead of asking what kind of a God would have saved the boy, why don't you ask what kind of a 28-year-old woman would get behind the wheel of a car under the influence of alcohol and place in jeopardy the lives of everybody else on the road that night? Why don't you ask that question? I said, okay. And I said, well, here's a good one. What about all those babies in Africa or, you know, Ethiopia with the little arms about that big, starving to death? Why does that happen? How could, what kind of a God would let the babies starve? She said, really? You blame that on God? I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. And she said, there's no dearth of food on this planet. We have silos of grain filled to the top all over the world. There's no shortage of food. There is enough food on the planet Earth that nobody should ever go to bed hungry. Don't ask what kind of a God would let the babies in Ethiopia starve. You need to be asking what kind of people. And in that moment, it was like, I got it. I blamed God my whole life for everything that was wrong instead of taking responsibility, right? And I started looking at things from a different angle. And I started to explore this theory of God. Like maybe God and I, you know, maybe we're not separate. I always thought that there really was a God, but that he was up there, out there somewhere. Because when she asked me some very basic, fundamental questions about God, where do you think he is? I said, I don't know. I suppose he's in heaven. What do you think he's doing? Godding? I don't know. What does God do? I suppose he's very busy. He's turning embryos into babies and acorns into trees and, you know, answering a bazillion prayer requests every tenth of a second. He's just busy. He's God. And so what I found out was, so I just started reading. She's like, you know what? Here's what I want you to do. I just want you to pray every morning, ask God to direct your thoughts, your words, and your deeds. Just do that. I'm like, direct my thoughts, my words, and my deeds. She said, yep, just do that. Don't do anything. Just do that. And I'm like, okay. So I started praying every morning to a God that I didn't believe in and one that I didn't understand to direct my thoughts and my words and my deeds, because Sheila told me to do it. And Sheila had a twinkle in her eye. She seemed relatively happy. And I was locked up. I didn't have anything else to do. So I thought, okay, screw it. I'll just say this prayer. And so I started saying this prayer every day. And after about a month, we met up out in the yard. And she said, so how's that working for you? I said, I don't know. I'm saying this prayer every day, but I don't feel any different. It just feels awkward, like I'm talking to the wall. She said, good, just keep doing it. So I just kept doing it. And then I started to feel different, like I wasn't sending my prayers up there, out there somewhere, that I was sending it home. Like there was a place inside me that maybe God, you know, maybe he wasn't separate. And so then I started to really explore and read. And this is the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I'm about to share with you is just my experience. This isn't the gospel. This isn't the way that it should be. And this isn't even something that I'm saying you need to believe. This was just my experience. This is what I found when I went looking for God. What I found out is that God is definitely, definitely not up there, out there somewhere. Well, he is, because he's everywhere. But he is not separate from me. I cannot possibly separate God, because if I identify God as being up there, out there somewhere in heaven, and that heaven's up there, out there, and that's where he's at, then I've essentially separated us, because he's up there, out there, I'm down here, there's this space in between us which separates us. And what I found out is that you can't separate from God, that God is inside every person, every man, woman, and child, that God is in us. And I believe that, and I have evidence of that, like right now in this moment, everybody's heart's beating and nobody gets credit for that. Like, you can't say, well, I'm making my heart beat. No, you're not. Make it stop. Like, right? Stop it. You can. Your heart is beating right now in this moment because it is the will of God. Period. Period. Right? Tonight when we go to bed, everybody's fingernails are going to grow just a little bit. You know, and everybody's hair is going to grow just a little bit. Well, yeah, not most of us, not Steve. Steve won't grow, but most of us. And so there was my evidence. That was my proof. And then so I started to look at God from a different angle, because I thought he was a judge. And see, I have always thought that he was the scorekeeper. He's not the scorekeeper. I don't get punished by God. I get punished by the sin. It's the thing that I do. If I eat the chocolate cake and gain, God doesn't say, oh, I'm going to punish you. Here comes 10 pounds. No. I'm going to gain the weight because I committed the crime, right? we get punished. It's like this natural cause and effect. That's not God. That's just the laws of nature in effect in my life. And they're in effect in your life. And so when I start looking at God that way, I could change my perception because he's not out to get me. He's not the scorekeeper. And so I began to develop a relationship with a God of my understanding. And things started to change. And what I started to find out is that he was here the whole time. And I always pushed God away, and God never leaves. It's always Terry. I'm always the one that backs up, and God just wants me to be happy, joyous, and free, and he wants me to be abundant, and he wants to give me the ocean of abundance, and I go there with my little dropper, and I just take just a little tiny dropper full and say, that's all I'm worthy of, God. And God says, but I want to give you the ocean, right? But taking the ocean doesn't jive with my image of myself. I'm not worthy of the ocean. I'll just take my little dropper and go, right? So we just got to keep showing up until we figure out that droppers is not what God wants to give me, and I'm worth a little bit more than that. And so I ended up back up at the Northeast Pre-Release Center in Cleveland, Ohio again. I am 8 years into my incarceration. God, I need to move along with this story. Jeez. So at year eight, I'm back in Cleveland, and I went over to Recovery Services. I said to Miss Daniel, she's the director of the Recovery Services Department. She's in this little tiny office the size of my bathroom today. And I walked in there and I said, what kind of books do you have? And recovery tapes. And I was all enthusiastic about recovery. And, you know, I'd been locked up 8 years. I got two more to go. And I'm gaining an understanding of God and the, you know, or my God of my understanding and a recovery process. And she reaches up on the shelf. Now, this woman was not in recovery, which I find to be very interesting. And she pulls down off the shelf a box of 10 cassette tapes of a Joe and Charlie Big Book Weekend. And I'd never heard of them. And I thought, well, okay. She goes, maybe you'll find this helpful. I said, all right. So I took it back to my room. And at the 4 o'clock count, which is 45 minutes of downtime, I put on my little headset, put in cassette number one, pushed play, and in about 5 minutes I went, oh my God, so this is it. Like this is the first 164 pages of the Big Book. This is how this breaks down. And I listened to Joe and Charlie every single day from 4 o'clock to 4:45 for 2 years. I had those tapes in my possession. And I'd see Miss Daniels at the Thursday night meeting. Every Thursday there was an AA meeting. Miss Daniels, you need those tapes back yet? Are you still using them? I say, yep, I listen to them every single day. She said, you just keep them. So I had them in my possession. And, you know, I was released on a Sunday, so Friday I had to, because she's only there Monday through Friday, I had to walk those cassette tapes over there and give them to Miss Daniels. It was hard to do because it was part of my daily routine. If you'd say to me, Terry, who was your first sponsor? I would say to you it was Joe and Charlie. Because Joe and Charlie took me through the steps. It was through Joe and Charlie that I got gained an understanding of the first 164 pages, and I began to understand the Big Book and the program of recovery through the eyes and ears and the mouth of Joe and Charlie. And it started to change my life. Like my recovery program started to really take off. And real quick, this keeps popping in my mind. Like 2 years ago, I was speaking down in Little Rock, Arkansas, and Joe McHugh developed, and Kent was there, I think. Oh, he fell asleep on me. Bless his heart. I mean, must have had a long flight yesterday. Oh, I so threw you under the bus, dude. I love you, though. I do. I didn't mean to throw him under the bus. Let me say that for sure. I didn't know he was asleep when I said that. But so Kent Coleman and I were down in Little Rock, Arkansas. Remember that, Kent? He's nodding yes. Okay, he's awake. Now he's up. And so the hostess says, Terry, I'm going to pick you up, I don't know, at 9:30. Meet me down in the lobby. I got a surprise. I'm like, well, okay. We hop in this car, and guess where she took me? She took me to Serenity Path, and we got this tour of this facility where Joe McHugh from those tapes had started, and he, at that time, he had already deceased about a year before that, and his office was left untouched. It was left the way that it was the last day that he was there, and I was just so moved. Like, who would have ever thought when I was sitting on that bunk listening to those guys that someday, you know, someone's going to care enough about you to stuff you in a car and drive you to his facility, and you're going to get a tour. And I'm just a girl from Woodville, Ohio, that so many good things have happened to as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and just trying to do the next right thing. And so let's get out of prison. So, because there's like another 15 years, and I got like 10 minutes. And So October 2003. It was like a decade later. It was like 10 years later. On a Sunday morning, I get out of prison, and my mom's out in the parking lot, and I remember the gate buzzing and walking through the gate, and I remember thinking to myself, my God, this is where the rubber's going to meet the road. Like, did I mean what I said? Did I get enough work done? And is there something left undone that I need to be doing? And the first thought was, like, yes, like, I need to connect to Alcoholics Anonymous upon my release. And it's urgent. Like, I have to do it today. And it was a Sunday. And this voice in my head, I don't care. Like, they'd already given me the number. Miss Daniels had given me a phone number for my local central office in Toledo, but I didn't know where the meetings were. I didn't have a car. I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't know anybody in AA. I just knew that I had this number that I needed to call. And so I got out and I got home and situated it. And I want to share a quick story. This is, I haven't told this story in a long time. So on the way home from the prison, like, I hadn't been in public in 10 years, okay? So we stop at one of those turnpike plazas, you know, where they have like the McDonald's and you get gas and stuff like that. And, we were in line to get a cup of coffee, and then we were going to pee, and then we were going to get back on the road. And we're standing in this line, and my mother reaches in her purse, and she has some money, some cash, some dollar bills in her hands, and she's standing there holding this money, and I'm standing next to her, and I'm so excited. I'm like, I can't believe I'm in public. Oh, my God, I feel like I've got a tattoo right here that says ex-felon. And I'm just standing there, and I'm just busting at the seams, looking around the room, and I see that money, and I go, oh, my God, what happened to the money? And all of a sudden, it got real quiet, and everybody looked at me. Everybody in the line turned around. Even the cashier stopped and looked up, and my tattoo was flashing red. And my mom whispers, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I just got these great big giant heads on it. I couldn't tell a 5 from a 10 from a 20. Like, they had redesigned the dollar bill, and I missed that on the news somewhere along the way, and I didn't recognize money. And so I thought, oh my God, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut." And so we went into the restroom, and we come out of the restroom, and she beat me, and she was standing at the sink, and I approached the sink, and I was just going to wash my hands so we could get back on the road, and I said, how do I turn the water on? She said, oh, just stick your hand under that faucet. I said, what? So I stuck my hand under the faucet, and the water poured. I couldn't believe it. I said, oh, my God, how do you know? Unbelievable. This was just, I could stand here for an hour and tell you guys about what happened in 10 years that none of you, it's like the frog in the water this morning. Somebody was talking about the frog and, you know. So anyway, the world had changed so much. So anyway, I end up back home. I call them my central office and I tell them I need to get to a meeting, and they arranged all that, and someone gets me to a meeting. And at that meeting on that Sunday night, I said, I just got out of prison today. I don't want to drink again. And I don't have a car. I don't know where the meetings are. I don't have any phone. I don't know anything other than I don't want to drink again. I know that. And those women at that meeting were like, whoosh, you know, newcomer. And she's serious. She means business, buddy. And they meant business. They meant business. And those women stepped up to the plate. So then they started arranging my week. I'm going to get her Tuesday night. You get her Wednesday night. I'll come get her Thursday night. You're going to get her Tuesday night. And I didn't have anything to do. I didn't even have a job. And so, you know, like, I was just rolling with the flow. Yep, you just tell me when to be ready, and we're going. And so I dove into Alcoholics Anonymous head first. And you know what I want to say is, like, if you're new to AA, like, we need to speak up and say what we need. Like, I needed rides to meetings. I needed to know where they were. I needed to know who the women were in my area. And I spoke up and I said what I needed, and they stepped up to the plate and they met my needs. And so I was able to acclimate myself to the AA community in Northwest Ohio where I live. And I took a job at the local grocery store, scanning groceries, and in Woodville, where everybody knew me. Everybody knew what I did. But everybody didn't know I was coming home, and they'd walk into that grocery store to buy their gallon of milk, and there I was to scan it and take their money. And a lot of eyebrows were raised initially, and you know what? I'd raise an eyebrow at a girl like me, too. And it didn't take long. I never once said to anybody, I've changed. You need to give me another chance. I didn't have to, because I knew that my conduct would demonstrate that I had, in fact, changed. That, because God was working through me. So I'm scanning groceries, and an old friend comes in and said, you know, that eye doctor across the street is going to hire somebody. I think you'd be great for that job. And I said, okay. And I thought, what eye doctor in his right mind would hire an ex-felon that did 10 years in prison? okay. And so then I made the mistake of telling my sponsor. And about 3 weeks later, she said, how did it go when you went into the eye doctors? I said, oh, I'm not going to waste his time. The truth is I can't handle rejection at all. Like, me and rejection, we are out. And I knew they were going to reject me, so I just wasn't going to go over there. And she said, well, you know what? When I pick you up Friday for the anniversary, you're going to tell me how it went. So you've got all week to march in there and apply for that position. And that was like on a Monday. So Tuesday, I cleaned up, and I went in there when I got off work. And the only person that was there was the doctor's brother. The optician is the person who assists you after your eye exam. They help you with your frame and your contacts. They measure for your bifocal. So the optician was the doctor's brother. And I walked into the office, and I stuck my arm out. I said, I understand you're going to hire somebody. I'd like to apply for that position, but before I do, there's something I must tell you. That old man jumped up out of that chair, and he said, oh, for Pete's sakes, it's a small town. I already know about all that. I've been waiting on you for a month. I said, okay, scared me half to death. Do I really want this? Yes, I really want this. I really want this. And so what happened was the doctor and his brother were putting feelers out because the people that came there were residents of Woodville, and they were saying to them, we're going to hire someone. Who would you recommend? Who would you recommend? And people kept saying, Terry is across the street scanning groceries. She'd be great over here, but... And so they already knew. But see, the community had endorsed me, and I didn't know any of that was going on. You see, I got fear holding me back, and the Holy Spirit had already gone before me and made the crooked way straight, but I got fear holding me back. You see how powerful that junk is? And it's a lie. Fear's a liar. It told me I wasn't good enough. It told me that what doctor in the right mind would ever hire you? Ex-felon, flesh in, right? And there they were, waiting. They wanted to meet me, and they hired me on the spot. So I took I worked two jobs. I'm working for the eye doctor, I'm working at the grocery store. And about 2 years into my employment, the doctor's brother took ill with cancer and suddenly died, and I found myself the only employee. And Dr. Laub came in one day after the funeral and after the dust settled and said, Terry, I really need you to be licensed. Here's the literature you're going to study, and you're going to go to Columbus down to Columbus in the month of May, and you're going to take a test. I'm like, I am? And, oh, God. And so in January, I started studying, and I'm not good at math. And your prescription, that's all numbers. It's all like algebra. I am not good at that. And I started to study, and what I found out is that, you know what, I am. I'm kind of smart. And I went to Columbus, Ohio in May of 2006, and I sat and I took that test and I passed it. I'm a licensed optician in the state of Ohio. And that was a really big deal for me to do that. And then I started dating someone that I had dated in high school, an old friend, Eric Cruz. His mother was my English teacher, and so he grew up in a Beaver Cleaver family. He always naturally knows the right thing to do. It makes me crazy. And he just always has the right answer. And so we started dating shortly after my release because I knew he was really safe. And Eric and I ended up getting married. And so I've got this good job. I got this cool husband. I'm living in a nice house on the river, and how good does that get? And next thing I know... there's this law in the books in Ohio that you can file for your driver's license if you have a lifetime suspension, as I did, and if 15 years have passed, as it did for me, you're eligible to file. It's kind of like a clemency. You only got one shot. If the judge says no, you're done. You can't clog up the court system filing this thing over and over every year. So I filed for it, and the boy's mom showed up, and so did Channel 11 and Channel 13 and the Toledo Blade, and it just turned into... In 2010, like it were 17 years later, and I'm all over the news again, and it was, I can only imagine how hard it was for her. And when she had her opportunity, she got on the witness stand, and she said, I know for a fact that this woman still drinks and drugs. You cannot put public safety at risk. You cannot restore her driving privileges. And, you know, the old Terry would have been, you know, at the defendant's table next to my attorney going, no, I'm sober. And I didn't do any of that. I sat there in a state of calm and peace, and I listened to her because I understand that I killed her only son, and it is not for me to say how long her grieving process should last or even if she should ever forgive me. She can say things that are pleasing to her about me. If it pleases her to say it, then she's entitled to say it, right? I get that. And so we had this hearing, and at the end of the hearing, he issued a decision like 2 weeks later electronically, so everybody got it at the same time, and he didn't give my license back. He gave me a 3-year testing period. They put this ankle monitor on my foot and said, don't even use hairspray or perfume. It's extremely sensitive to alcohol. You'll wear that every day for 100 days at the cost of $15 a day. People would say, Terry, what is that big thing on your ankle? I'd say, oh, that's just my house payment. right? And I wouldn't let Eric pay for, and I mean, I paid thousands, and when it was all set, well, you figure the attorney, and then the old fines, and then the thing on my ankle, and the reinstatement fee, like it just, so anyway, we go back after 3 years. And then, you know, after the thing came off my ankle, I had to do breathalyzers and random urine drops, no less than once every 10 days. I did it for 3 years. And I go back to court in May of 2013, and the judge, he went just like this. And he looked at Mrs. Miller, and he said, I've got scientific data right here that backs up her claim that she is, in fact, sober. And I think it's in the interest of justice to restore her driving privileges, and we're going to do that today. And I have my driving privileges back. And I have a car, and like whoever ever saw that coming, and it just kept getting better. And there's more stuff I want to share, but I want to expedite this because I know I'm getting short on time. That was in June of 2013 when I started driving for the first time, and then in September of that year, a weird series of coincidences began to happen in my life. It seemed like every meeting I went to, somebody would say, if I had an opportunity to go to my mama's grave and I put my 5-year coin on her stone, and I know she was there, and that meant so much. Or then I was at a meeting, and I heard a guy say, I went to Aunt Betty's funeral, and I put a 6-month chip in her coffin, and that meant so much. And I mean, it just kept coming up every meeting, and I didn't go unnoticed by me. I remember saying a prayer, God, are you trying to tell me something? Am I supposed to go to his grave? Nope, didn't hear anything. Nope. I'm sure that I didn't hear anything. And so I blew that off. And then in early October, I get this private message on Facebook from this guy named Vance from Tennessee. And I always used to say, I don't know how he found me because I never spoke in the state of Tennessee. Well, I can't say that anymore because now I spoke in the state of Tennessee today, the first time. And so this kid sends me this private message and he says, Terry, he goes, I just want to thank you. I just listened to your CD. And he attached a link to his sentencing hearing. He had done what I did, and he just wanted to thank me. And how he found me on Facebook with the limited information I provided in my talk was pretty stunning to me. And a little detective, I don't know, a little Inspector Clouseau. And so I sent him a message back. I said, you know what, that's why I do the deal. And so we became friends on Facebook. And then at the International in Atlanta, I got to actually meet him. And it was just a really cool thing for both of us. Like a week later, he sends me a private message. He says, Terry, as part of my sentence, I'm supposed to go to my victim's grave once a year, every year, on the anniversary of the death, of his death, of the accident, and it's tomorrow. Is there anything you'd recommend? Sure. My fingertips are smoking. I'm typing texting so fast, and I'm telling him all the things that I would do if I had enough courage to do what the universe has asked this 25-year-old kid to step up to the plate and do. Take your coin. Tell him that he didn't die in vain, that you're sober, and, you know, I'm telling him all these things. And I gave him my cell phone number. I said, Vance, I'll make myself available between 4 and 6. Would you please call me after that's done? Let's process that together. Like, he thinks I'm going to help him. He has no idea how much this kid's going to help me, right? So I call him up, and I'm hanging on this kid's every word. What did that feel like? How long were you there? Were you scared when you arrived? What was the air like? You know, and like, we're on the phone for like an hour, and it's all about me, and he has no idea, right, because he's processing through his stuff. And so then about 2 weeks later, October the 19th, I celebrate 20 years. Been sober for 20 years. The thought occurred to me when I got my coin, maybe I'm supposed to take this to the cemetery and put it on the kid's stone. No. Because I don't have coins 1 through 9. My first coin is a 10-year coin because I was incarcerated. So those coins are all in a little velvet pouch in my jewelry box, and this one is going to go in there with those, I assure you. Well, within 48 hours, I had 3 20-year coins because everybody wanted me to have their 20-year coin. And they just kept turning up. And I'm like, real funny, God. And so I put one in my jewelry box with the rest of them, one at my home group in the little plastic container we all have, and I stuck one in my car just in case. And then the kicker came the following week. I was in training. I have to do so many hours of optical training annually to keep my license current, and I'm sitting in this training program. I'm not paying any attention to anything anybody said. I'm thinking about all the weird coincidences. I'm thinking about how close I am to the cemetery where that kid's buried, and I'm thinking about Vance, my friend from Tennessee, and the 3 20-year coins, and they get, you know, they're talking about the transition lenses, the light and the darken and sunshine, and I'm not paying attention. They give us a 10-minute break, and we go outside, and then the thought was, you know, maybe I should swing by there when I get done here. I'm so close. I was like 5 miles away, and then the thought was, you know, you would need $15 if you went to the cemetery, and I'm sure I don't have any cash in my purse. I only have plastic. And I thought, why would you need $15 to go to a cemetery? I don't know. So we go back in, we sit down, the counselor or the instructor says, I want to see who was paying attention. So he puts a screen up of the 5 transition lenses that are available in the U.S. market. And he says, everybody take a piece of paper, number it 1 through 5, and identify these 5 lenses. And I'm like, oh God, like 2 of them were obvious. The other 3 were so subtle. And so I just took my best guess, and because I wasn't paying attention to the previous presentation, 30 opticians in that room training. Only 1 of those 30 got all 5 right. Yours truly. Wait a minute, it gets better. For getting all 5 right, the instructor walked over to the table where I was sitting, and he laid in front of me 3 $5 bills. That's the honest to God truth if I ever told it. I'm not making this up. I swore to God. I thought, I am not going to sit here till the ceiling falls down on top of my head. I will go. I swear to God. As soon as I'm done here, I am going to the cemetery. And that was in the winter. Well, it was in October, so it was getting dark, like at, I don't know, 6 o'clock then, 6:30. And so on that Sunday evening, when the program finished at 4 or 5, I hopped in the car, ran across the street to a Walmart, and I spent the $15 on a spray of silk flowers, and I drove straight to the cemetery, and I went to his grave, and I made an amends. And I had my 20-year coin. And I went up to his stone, and I knelt down in front of his stone, and I told him how sorry I was, and I really meant it. And there was this little old beat-up matchbox car that at one time it appeared to have been white, and all the paint was worn off of it. It obviously had been sitting there for 20 years. And I told this 14-year-old boy that he didn't die in vain. Then I've been flying all around the place, and like there's people all over the country that have heard his story and that know about him. And I knew, like I knew, I just had this feeling that he knew and that he had forgiven me a long time ago. And I can't even tell you, like I was there, I bet you I was there for 2 hours. I just got so comfortable. I just laid down on top of his grave, and I didn't want to leave, and then it started getting dark out, and I thought, this is getting creepy. You need to go home. And so I got in the car, and I went home, and, you know, it just really had a profound effect on me, and I don't know. Fear is such a liar. It held me back. It kept me away from doing the right thing. And I guess that's my message today. I don't know who's struggling with fear, but that's today's focus. Fear. And so I've worked with my sponsor. Actually, I had the same sponsor for 18 years. She died of breast cancer. And I had a sponsor that lived in California that didn't work. Just because she was so far away, I never saw her. Then I realized, oh, I don't need a sponsor on the other side of the country. I need someone that's like I can see. And so I got a nearby sponsor, and I'm like, I want to work on this amends. How do you make amends? How do you make an amends for that? And she told me that I would make my amends through right living, by consistently doing the next right thing, by showing up and putting on a pot of coffee at the meeting, by setting up tables and chairs, by sponsoring other women, by giving up a weekend to go, and it's a privilege to get to come and do this. And every time I step up to a microphone and I share my experience, strength, and hope, I move just a little bit closer to my amends. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.